I've been asked to talk about evolution tonight, so I'm going to talk about involution instead. That's evolution the other way up. It's a very important concept, because the peculiar thing about Western concepts of evolution consists in that they imagine some primary substance with no qualities of any significance other than mere existence, and then they proceed to draw out of this empty hat intelligent beings through a series of fortuitous collisions of assumed atoms. Now, if we take evolution to signify bringing something out from a situation or a substance, then we have to account for the qualities that emerge being in the substance from which they emerge. So if a human being exists, we have to say that the configuration of forces in the human being must be an inherency of ultimate reality, the origin from which humanity came. So we have to posit inside the original substance in some manner such attributes that when they are developed will be equivalent to a human being. The first thing to observe that the human being has certain attributes that we call intelligence and so on, which enable him to do something that is utterly beyond argument. I mean, it's beyond argument that he does it, namely argue. Anybody who argues that mankind does not in fact argue is refuting himself. So we have to posit that in the primary substance of reality, whatever the word substance means, there are certain attributes which, when developed, constitute an argumentative being. Now, although Western thought has, in the last 1,000 years, been materialistically biased, in the 20th century we have seen, effectively, the material basis of reality seriously questioned and finally demonstrated to be really mass energy. If we therefore posit that reality, whatever it is, has as its first manifestation energy, we cannot be far wrong. Now, we have to discuss each term that we use, because if we don't discuss the term and we merely use it without definition, we can be in serious trouble, because the term itself contains, telescoped into it, a series of concepts. So that if we accept the term, we are accepting concepts. If we don't understand the concepts we are accepting, we will actually be determined in our thought process by it. The thought process will be mechanically determined by the terms employed. When we use the word term in logic, we are using a word signifying a word used in a specially clearly defined sense. If you say a word, you're not being as precise as if you say a term. A term implies that you have a word which has been very carefully defined. Now let's consider that if evolution signifies that something is coming out of an ultimate reality or substance, the problem is raised, how can that which is coming out have got in to that original reality? So if I write down here in vol, and I can make in signify as a diagram a closed area with some energy entering that closed area, and I make vol equal volition, or a turning in, as in the word volute, then if something turns into this area, I have to posit that what is turning in was already, prior to the in-turning, out. It was extended in space before it posited itself in a locus or finite situation. Now, if I talk about evolution, I'm using the word E as a short form of X, out-turning, then I must say something is inside that which is under consideration, which we may call substance or original reality. That which is turning out must somehow be in. But if I define it, that I start with the substance with certain qualities within it, I must say the qualities either got into it from outside it, or they are inherent in it itself. Now, if I say that they got into it from outside, I then have the problem of what were they outside? What is the meaning of outside existence? If I posit that it gets out, I have the problem, how did it get in? If I postulate that it gets in, what was the situation that was out before it got in? Both of these things are unanswerable right from the beginning of the argument. But if we say that there are inherences, there are essential powers which are reality in the original, these essential powers can function in the manner we call involution and outvolution, inturning and outturning, and by postulating that the powers themselves move either towards the centre, which is involution, or from the centre, which is evolution, the argument shifts from the relation of involution to evolution to the nature of the inherences in ultimate reality. The idea of starting with substance was quite simple, that the Greek Thales, who postulated the primary substance, was in fact standing on the earth. He wanted to know what was it that was firm, the least unshakable thing in all the things around him, the thing that he could find and stand upon and say, this thing will not change. He was looking for an unchangeable. When he looked at the earth upon which he stood, he found that this earth was in certain places dry, and he could not imagine, by examining this dry earth, how it could become wind, fire, and so on. So he looked for something else. He found humidity in certain parts of the earth, apart from the fact that, as a Greek, he's surrounded by the ocean anyway. He then decided that because water could exist in various phases, you could take liquid water as a sort of mean and say if you heat it, it will become invisible, water vapour, and if you freeze it, it will become a solid. But he wanted something that would be conserved through all changes. He chose water because of its flexibility, its plasticity, and the strange fact that you can freeze it, and that you can boil it and turn it into invisible vapour, and so on. So it was not a bad guess. It was easier to imagine that water could become ice and water could become vapour than it was to imagine that earth could turn into water and then into air. It was easier because he had the evidence of this change actually there. He could climb up the mountains in the winter and find nice blocks of ice. He could watch them melt in the spring. He could catch them and put them in a pan and boil them, or even go to a volcano and boil a bit by travelling a little further. So he had here an evidence of something that he called stuff of the universe, and this stuff, he said, is quite probably water. Other people said, well, water isn't dynamic enough on its own. What is it that moves the waves on the sea? It is air. Perhaps air is prior to water. Another man thought fire, because when things are hot, when the sun is hot, it creates movements of the air. There was a quite distinct difference of thought pattern in the man who was looking for substance, something enduring and unchangeable, and the man who was looking for primary cause. When you think about causes, you're thinking about forces, which, when applied, produce changes. When you think about substance, you tend to think about that which is fundamentally unchanging. So we have here, right from the beginning, two opposed concepts. A concept of an enduring, unchangeable substance, and a concept of a dynamic cause, which is continuously changing its forms, and mysteriously not being a substance at all. A substance is something which you can, in principle, conceive yourself to stand upon. It is substantia, it is underneath, and you can stand on it. Now, fire is not underneath, and you can't stand on it, not comfortably. Heraclitus thought to himself, fire is a better bet than water, because it is concerned with causation, with forces, with power, with changes, and the induction of changes. But that merely said something about his temperament. We saw here two temperaments very obviously opposed. A temperament concerned with stability, those who like to believe that substance is ultimate, and another temperament concerned with causation, who like to think that energy is basic. Now, factually, in the 20th century, we know that matter can be destroyed and be turned into powers, into forces, into energies. And in this process of turning it into energy, we're turning it into something on which you cannot stand in any firm manner. The universe of the 20th century is far nearer to Heraclitus and his fire theory than it is to Thales and his water theory. Now, if we conceive what today we know to be a fact, that if forces are made to condense, if we can tie them up by any trick, device, and locate them, these forces will then behave in a manner such that a consciousness from outside will interpret them as matter. Matter is energy, locatable, and offering a resistance. We cannot explain energy in terms of energyless particles. We can exchange the concept of rotating energies for material bodies. So therefore, when we come to consider involution, we must say to ourselves that our governing concept is one in which we are vectoring, we are directing a field of energy. Here is a field. A field is a zone of influence. Influence is inflowingness. Imagine a field which is indeterminable in its extended form, but it has this peculiar attribute of being able to precipitate itself onto a center. And when it does so, it brings into being, by the meeting of these forces, what we call an existential material object. An existential material object is then viewed as a precipitation of a field. The field itself, from the point of view of modern physics, being a space-time continuum of energy. When it presses into centers, in any given locality, it produces, by the impressing, the involving, local zones of compaction, which, relative to the space between, can be called bodies. These bodies now constitute the possibility of a granular analysis of reality. Whatever has been involved into the zone we call a material body, the attributes of that which is involved are now inside this zone. We have therefore to say that if we accept the hypothesis that matter is precipitated energy, then the attributes of energy are in the matter. So that if we release this matter from its condensed state, we will rediscover the attributes of the field that precipitated this matter. Now, in the case of an articulate human being, because a human being can actually think, feel, will, coordinate, and embody by self-condensation, these processes, we have to say that prior to condensation, prior to this self-precipitation, this field is able to feel, think, will, coordinate, and incarnate. It has these attributes of itself. We cannot conceive this field to be lacking something that we manifestly have. So we have to say that the original reality from which we derive in some mysterious way is a field of intelligent energy, thinking, feeling, and willing, self-condensing to make bodies. The whole process of the movement from the field into the body is then called involution. Now, supposing we say that when we condense particles in a field in this way, we can conceive that because the field is sentient, it feels, it will feel in itself these particles as zones of resistance and experience them as physical bodies, primary atoms, molecules, and so on. In the act of feeling them, it is in danger of focusing upon them and forgetting the area between these particles. Between these particles in the field, this field is very, very fine. If I bang my knuckle on here, it makes a bigger noise of a low frequency than it does if I bang it without knocking my gross physical knuckles on the board. But to a very, very fine perceptive organism, this banging without touching at the gross level is actually louder than the other. A greater increase of sensitivity would mean that instead of hearing only noises of the gross order, we could hear the imagination knocking on an imaginary wall. And if we refine our instrument of perception, the noise that we could hear would be amplified way beyond the banging of a knuckle on the board at the gross material level. We can therefore say that the field can devote itself to a particle structure, a molecular structure, an organism, and forget the subtleties of the field round it. And when a being arises that can devote itself in this way to the concrete, gross material, we have got a materialistic empirical scientist. Now, those of you who have watched a cat looking in the air and dodging invisible entities and clutching at them and standing up very alarmed can say either the cat is mad or it is aware of something that the grossly materially focused man is not. The Egyptians made the cat sacred for a variety of things. The lowest cause of its sacredness was the fact that it could kill rats and mice. Another one was that it could be trained to catch ducks and other things. But there were various other more subtle ones, that the cat was very sensitive to other forces than the gross material objects that a finitely focused man is tuned into. Therefore, we can see that if we actually focus onto this knock-knock level, if we imagine that we continue to do this and we define as real only that which makes a noise like this, we will arrive at a corpuscular theory of reality. We will lock in space energies of our imagination in a concept of granularity. We will do that because our experience denies this all the time. If I look around this room and start counting heads, I am doing that deliberately. Heads are the hardest things you've got, I hope. And therefore, it's easier for me to keep them discrete. But if I tried to count heat auras from your body, I would find it extremely difficult to separate it out. If I looked at David with infrared type eyes, I would see that actually he's encroaching on zero with his heat aura. I might think he's actually being cheeky if I didn't know he was married. So that only at a certain low level can I use a discrete counting system significantly. At other levels, I will be forced to become looser and looser and looser in my analysis, until at the top level it will be quite fallacious, and that's what the word fallacious means, quite fallacious to think that there is any discrete, separable existential entity in the universe. At the top level we are dealing with a continuum which is higher than the concept of energy of physics, a process that has to be verified with instruments not yet developed, instruments so refined compared with modern electronic devices, instruments that in 1,000 years will record what today could not even be conceived as forces because they're too fine. Forces that will go through a Faraday cage which would stop electromagnetic waves, but which cannot stop something else for which a term is needed, a term that is absent in modern physics. Every science has to develop terms to keep pace with its own concepts. Certain new terms will emerge that will cover types of sensitivity now very rarely found, but which will become in the future common properties of sentient human beings. Imagine that if we concentrated on the knock-knock world and we agreed between ourselves that we would say that is real which makes a noise when you kick it and that is unreal which does not, we could become gross material empirical scientists. We could go around kicking everything and writing in a book what happened when we kicked it. We can make nice big fat books of statistics of the way everything falls apart when you kick it with a certain force over a certain number of times and so on. But this peculiar world would actually be an abstraction. It would be something that our intellect had fabricated from itself. Now imagine in the 12th century human beings were quite capable of going down the road and saying, I've seen an angel today, and they wouldn't mean a gross material physical body. If they had a vision which, say, modern psychologists might call a projection or a hallucination, they didn't think it was any such thing. They attributed to it exactly what it was, an existential reality of its own order. If they saw a ghost, they didn't think a ghost was a non-ghost, called figment of the imagination. They thought it was a ghost. Now, actually, you cannot conduct an industrial revolution with people like this about. And therefore, the industrial revolution had to get rid of ghosts. Imagine, supposing you wanted to erect a mill, and the place where you wish to erect it happens to be a convergence of rivers, because you need some water. But it happens that 400 years ago, a man barbarously murdered, that's for the lady on the back row, barbarously murdered his three daughters and his wife in a fit of bad temper. Now any sensitive person going there starts shaking violently. Now until a man invents some kind of industrially useful thing that needs shaking and puts it in the hand of these shakers, it's no good. So there had to be a new philosophy. A philosophy that denies all psychic forces and insists that that is real which helps the production of cotton or wool or whatever you need to produce. After a few hundred years of this kind of concept, people actually came to believe that everything that they can't kick is hallucination. And of course this means to say that large areas of possible experience recede from the mind. Because when this sentient field, which we loosely call the mind, the evaluator, focuses down to a certain level, for it other levels cease to be functional. Now we come to a point where we can say the dead end of involution is the moon. The moon as we know it, examined by astronauts, is something that you can go up to and stand upon and jump about on and behave like a 15-year-old fool and forget what you went for and so on. And it has no organic life on it. We can say that the moon is the end of minerality. The MN in mineral means that you can count it. Now, the mineral world is very useful. It's like the moon. You know that you can count the moon because it's not likely, statistically, to effloresce, grow plants overnight, and these turn into things that you get on TV plays, and these become metamorphosed into animals, and these into strange spatial type beings of no bodily abode, and disappear. So that the next time we come to say, what time of the moon is it, Sylvia? She says, I'm sorry, the moon has disappeared. Statistically, we expect the moon to remain. And therefore, we can say of this moon, it is good to call it the dead end of involution. In Indian thought, it is a place devoted to ancestors. If you go to the moon when you die, you'll come back to Earth and start breeding babies because you're on the way called Pitriyana, the way of the ancestors. And this is because in Indian philosophy they conceive minerality itself to be the dead end of a contracting field. When it can no longer contract, when it's reached its final compaction, we call it end. Now, you Latin scholars know that EN is giving you a base that you see in entity, ens and so on, which means being. But the letters actually mean field motion. And when we put a D on it and say N de, we could really write E for a field, N for the motion, and D here. So END means a field moving till it divides itself from another moving field dividing itself. Self-precipitation here results in a division between that center and that center. And this is what we mean by end. An end is an involutionary movement carried to its term. When it cannot further contract, it is what we call minerality. A mineral is that which is so established, so secure, so relatively unchangeable that we can suspect that it will be there tomorrow. The diamond that your wife has bought by you out of the great love you have for wives and diamonds. You give her that diamond and it's so hard and shiny, she puts it in a drawer. You know it will be there tomorrow if a burglar hasn't come in the night. And if he has, you know that it will be somewhere else. So the thing about minerality is you have a very, very strong belief that you will actually be able to locate it somewhere in space. And it's so hard that you tend to believe, and people have believed for a long time, that diamonds are indestructible. Factually, of course, they are destructible because they are only energy. But it is quite hard to reduce diamonds to wavicles of force. But it is in principle possible. The amount of energy to do that is very high. Now let us have a look at this concept of end. End means the field has moved in such a way that it has produced precipitations in different zones, and these zones of precipitation can be conceived to be divided from each other. Now the division between these fields is not an ultimate division, it is an effective division. Now effective means ex-factive. It is out, ex, and facere, to make, to do. When we come travelling along and get stopped, we come to the end of our journey for the time being. We know that this field has simply vibrated towards the centre and produced this phenomenon called primary particle. We know that the other primary particle is simply an evidence that the field has moved towards another centre outside the first centre. But we also know that the field itself is a continuum which is utterly beyond the possibility of disruption. So there is no absolute severance between two centres, which we call bodies. All bodies are modalities of a continuum, the attributes of which must include thought, feeling, volition, coordination, and possible self-condensation, which we can call incarnation. Now, if we make a mnemonic of the process, we can draw ourselves primitive type hand. Neo-primitive hands cost £40,000 when well painted. The thumb we are going to call power, and I want to use this word power here in a special way. The etymology of that word power actually comes from a word from which we get the word push, and the word ver, which means man. Whether you spell it Latin wise, V-I-R, or Teutonic wise, W-E-R, as in werewolf, it is the same word, power and man, push man. You push things with your thumb. But we must distinguish between the use of the word power in philosophy from the use of the word power when you are considering problems in physics and mechanics and so on. Power as a rate of work done is not what we're talking about. We're talking about push, that which produces motion and which is inherent in ultimate reality. Now imagine that we have a field that is an area of influence, and that this area of influence receives the name power, which means that the field itself can actually push, like a man pushes. And then we have to remember that man means an evaluator. So we have to say that this field is a self-evaluating pusher. Sounds like a description of a friend of mine. And when this field of power presses in to centres, it produces forms. So on the next finger, we shall write form. That's my index finger. A thumb for a pusher, my first finger, the index finger. When I use my index finger, I do it to indicate forms. Now remember, at this point, we are not talking about the concept of matter or the concept of substance, we're talking about shape, divorced at the moment from the idea of substance. We can visualize a sphere in our imagination or in the air. If you're very good at concentrating, you begin to see one. And then if you're very good at losing control of yourself when you've seen one, you can go away and have a rest. Under somebody's care, of course. When you formulate in this way, you are generating what is called an idea. So we'll put idea under there as well. And as the subject matter of thought and intellect is called idea, we can say that this index finger pertains to your intellect. Remember, this is a mnemonic device. If we wanted to prove ontological validity for this, and neurological significance for it, we can do so. But for the time being, we will simply say that in evolutionary terms, the thumb has been used for pushing and the first finger for indicating forms. And a form in your mind is called an idea. That's why when men get ideas and talk to each other, they emphasize their ideas with the first finger. What they're really doing is indicating authoritatively the forms that they have in their mind. If you find a man that's wagging his ring finger at you like this, you feel that there's something wrong with his authority. Men that wag their first finger at you when they indicate something are usually being rudimentary. They funny thing about the middle finger is pertaining to Heraclitus and his fiery philosophy, and as fire and thirst are the same word, funnily enough, your middle finger in his philosophy corresponds and is the mnemonic for fire. But in this analysis, the middle finger, we are going to put the word desire down, and we're going to put for it preferred response, a preferred response. When you apply your pushability, you give rise to a form. That is, if you move about with great energy, with your eyes closed, you will meet forms. And in the process, you will find, those of you that have been to Esalen to be therapeutized, and have had your eyes closed, and put those hands on forms in space, will find a peculiar thing. You put your hand with your eyes closed on one form, and you find that form is rather interesting. You put it on another one here, and you think that is less interesting. You put it in a form there, and you wonder whether it's safe. Now, this middle finger here, we shall use to remind ourselves of preferred responses, which we call desires. Remember, we're talking about involution. A field of power, that is influence, flowing in, precipitates a form. The same field of power investigates the form and finds the form is pluralized internally, and then it has differences within it which give rise to preferred responses. Each form behaves in a different way. Now, when this preferred response is selected from total reality, a field of power devotes itself to that zone. This is a very important thing. The desire, the preferred response, is the action of the power on the form. The form contains dialectically an infinity of possibilities of action, an infinity of formal distortions. And some of these are selected, and the power then devotes itself to the selected forms. We then have a situation in which a form selected has power drifting into it and circulating round it. Now, I'm going to write on this ring finger biofield, because when the power moves in, involves to the form and selects within the form that which it prefers and devotes itself to the preferred, a certain amount of energy wraps round the chosen form. And that is a biofield, a field of life for that form. That means that wherever we have an interest of a biased order, if we prefer one thing to another, we wrap a certain amount of energy round it. We say we are being possessive when we do this. If we think it's worth responding to, we want to put it where we can get at it, so that we can give it our preferred responses. The energy that we precipitate round it is a biofield. That is a field of life energy. From the absolute power, there is a step down to formulation, because all formulation implies circumscription. Circumscription already makes a shell of energy round it, so that the energy on the outside is freer than the energy on the inside. And in passing through the enclosing membrane, a certain amount of energy is expended, and therefore when the energy has got inside, it's slightly weaker than the energy outside, and therefore it is confined within that membrane. It is an encapsulated energy. When we have selected the form and given this analysis that causes preferred response, desire, and we devote the energy into that field, the energy so devoted is a biomagnetic field. Once we have such a zone, because we have a lot of zones like this, and we select one, and we press into that one all our energy, we push our willpower, we condense our form, we drive our preferred energies into it. We have made a biofield into which we keep pushing more energy. This is ingestion, involution of field energy into the pattern of the preferred response. The result is that we have a physical body generated inside the biofield. Now the whole of this process is involution. We can say that the body of a human being, when it is alive and moving about, the fact that it is animate, that is, it can move, means that there is a biofield there. You know that you can get a living tree and you can cut pieces off that tree in the act called pruning, and the tree will respond by growing in another direction. And you may do this for a number of years, and then one day you go, you don't need to prune it, it is dead. If you now examine it, you will find it has no biofield. There's a measurable biomagnetic field wherever there's a living being. And that field is not caused by the body, but is the cause of the body. It is that field that has drawn into itself those primary particles or energy quanta and packed them in and made the body within the field. Therefore we can say, if we examine the body of a human being and it is animate and running about and disagreeing with you and things like that, then we can say it is a biological entity. It is an entity with a field of force around it which makes it live. It can grow, it can ingest food, break it down, reduce it to energy, and use it for its own purpose. And then, if we find a being is running about, and we observe that this being runs in some directions and not in other directions, we can say that that being has preferred directions. The fact that each species of animal tends to pursue its own species is an indicator of preferred responses. When a certain animal chases another animal, it has inside itself a function, which is a response that it intends to give to another member of the same species, if it can catch it. The biomagnetic field itself, when observed, will always show preferred responses in it. The fact that a kangaroo chases kangaroos and elephants chase elephants and so on means that in the psyche, in the level of sentience of that being, there is a form. And that form is related to the involution of power that has, after precipitation, pluralized itself in the process called generation of individuals of that species. So the forces that condense and become elephant are formally different from the forces that condense and become lounge lizard. All the forces that are condensing are condensing in a formally different way. When we find a zone of preferred response, we know that there are forms inside that being that are already stressed and precipitated in a special way. And this is very important for conversation with human beings, because if we meet a body in a train and this body is snoring, unless some electronic wizard has put a snorer in his hat to fool us, he is alive and he has preferred responses, like sleeping on trains on long journeys and so on. We know that he has a form inside him, and therefore we can wake him up and cross-question him about his forms and say, why are you snoring? And why glissando and not in steps like a diatonic scale? And so on. And because he has form, he will respond in a formal way. It's a very interesting experiment. I love trains for this very fact. Last time I was on a train doing this with a fellow, the window suddenly shattered and illustrated a point that we were about to discuss. And I said to the window, "You're a bit quick." I hadn't got that far yet. And we all filled our pockets full of bits to remind ourselves of this conversation. Now, there's a hidden form inside every preferred response. Now, because every form is an encapsulated zone of energy, we know that this form must have been hidden inside the power. So we are forced to say that the field power, which is the origin of all things and which involves progressively down to the physical body level, this field power mysteriously is structured. It is not plain. It is not through itself everywhere identical formally. It is only a continuum with sameness as its quality, providing we don't say that sameness means identical form in different areas. We have no ground whatever for assuming identity of form in two zones in space. To the contrary, we have every justification for saying that no two zones of space can be formally identical in their energy pattern. Now let us imagine what we've done. We start with an infinite field of power. This power, because it has all the qualities that we have, without which we couldn't have expressed them, this power field is structured because it is power. Power is not doing nothing, it is doing everything. And in its crisscrossings and interweavings, it produces an infinity of forms, and in no two zones of space are those forms identical. So that every form that is produced within it is unique. Two forms which are adjacent to each other in space are not identical and cannot be. One is nearer or farther from a centre of earlier precipitation or more intense precipitation. One is peripheral. One may be vectored peripheral and the other towards the centre. No two are identical, and therefore it is a waste of time from the word go to try to find a person with whom you will agree absolutely formally. This is impossible. The more you discuss, the more differences you will find, except for one fact, and that is your will to differ. This is very important for coming to harmonious conclusions in debate. If you accept that in any two zones of space the precipitation is unique, you can see the enrichment of the banks of the Thames, the enrichment of the field by this infinitely various process of self-precipitating. Therefore, if you imagine a conversation between two beings, if they think they are going to come to formally identical conclusions at the end of their debate, they're already wrong. The longer they debate, the more differences they will discover, except for the one fact that they are willing their differences. Now, if they didn't will their differences, if they were able, if they had enough control of their energy to will not differences but identity, they would suddenly flip together like two monocells do if you watch them under a microscope. It is possible that two beings in different places could actually precipitate themselves and occupy the same space. And this they would do by agreeing to resonate in the same way. There can only be agreement formally between people who will the same form. And this they can only do for some willful purpose. This means that if you do agree with anybody, it isn't because you agree. It's because you will to agree. Your agreement has no more validity than your will to agree. Now, we have an infinite field, structured because it is dynamic. Structure there does not mean rigid, it means that the powers that are passing infinitely through space are, in their crisscrossings, weaving a mesh of power, which, because this power is sentient, it sees as itself, self-experience, self-imperience, and in looking at these weavings of forces, by focusing on them in particular ways, in particular zones, it can seize and relatively freeze for a time being a given form while it examines it. In the same way that if you look inside your mind on a sleepless night, you will find that the forces in your mind are continuously weaving all kinds of forms. You can practice sharp focus on one of those forms, and the moment you do so, you energize it, it comes out of context, the others begin to fade away. Or you can deliberately relax more and more until the associations between these forms are no longer conducted by formal relationships of the logical order, but by emotional charges, that is, by like-dislike, tendencies in a field of sentience. This infinite field is structured from eternity. Eternity is not a lot of time. It is simply that time is a serialization of certain functions within that field. The field itself is beyond the concept time. Time always implies an energy emission. But as soon as we descend to the level of form, in the act of creating form, that is encapsulation, we have created the possibility of time. Because time implies that we have a clock. And this clock implies that some order of rotation is occurring to make a cycle of observations. When we come into the realm of form, therefore, we are already entering into the realm of time. When we get preferred responses, we further energize this time. When we pour further energy and make a biomagnetic field and ingest it into a body, then we have brought time into a more condensed. And if we kill this body and finish up with minerality, we then have a particle like the moon, which can serve as a fairly stable measurer. The whole process is one of involution, and nothing has gone in to that body other than qualities to which the field must be viewed as father. That field is God the Father. This form is God the Son. This preferred response is the Holy Ghost. This biofield is the life, and this is the body. So if you say God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Ghost, the life that issues from those three, and the body, then we have a thing here that's quite easy to reconcile with a Trinitarian Christianity, or with certain high philosophies of India and elsewhere. Always the concept of the father is the pushing fellow, because in primitive societies, this is excluding America, the father pushes. This pushing father generates an idea which he calls his son, and he tries to nail the idea to do what the father wants, like keep the business going. And he thereby tries to create a preferred response in the son, and if he manages it, there will be some biomagnetic concentrations on the business. But terrestrial fathers haven't sufficient energy to force their sons in precisely the same way that God the Father could have done. But of course this field of power called God the Father hasn't got the values of a time-conditioned human being, because he is an eternal power. Therefore when he involves, he is not trying to make a concept of a body of people, a community of identical thought. We take an example in church history. We find right at the beginning of Christianity, after the statement, love God and your neighbour as yourselves, and be ye conformed one to another, etc., etc., the idea that there is a community that will have exactly the same ideas about everything, and this community will be called the Kingdom of God. That is a pipe dream. Factually, right at the beginning of Christianity, we have tremendous disagreements, factions everywhere. We have men who believe that Christ is really God, and other men that believe he's only half a God. some that believe that he's just a very clever fellow, some that believe he was an idiot who had no political insight, and so on. These are all different points of view, and the winner of all the arguments, who actually used an army to enforce his argument, defined the others as heresies. Heresy, of course, means I do my own thinking. But in this process of involution, we have to continuously remind ourselves that when we examine inside our own organism, we will always find unique processes of thought, of feeling, of will, unique modes of coordinating these, unique modes of incarnating them in the physical body. So that we must never look for formal agreement with other beings. We must look for something totally different. Namely, two kinds of beings. Beings that know they are willful in their definitions, and beings who think that their definitions are valid independently of being willed. The first kind, who know that they will their definitions, are Franciscans, and the second kind, who believe that the thought is there and has power to condition the will, are Dominicans. This means that as far as we are concerned, as human beings, each one of us has a unique mode of internal involution. The Western concept of evolution is that we have come from a very low type protoplasm. We have been like an amoeba, we have been like fish, we have been like lizards, we have climbed out, and we have finally become man in a most mysterious way. This other view says that if we examine ourselves internally, we will find within our body, first, animation, the biofield, second, preferred responses, third, forms behind our preferred responses, and behind those forms, will. We are actually biased. Bias, bios. Our life is a bias. And if we accept this bias and then say, how very interesting that there are so many biases, what a rich world it is, how beautifully we disagree, and say, disagree some more with me, it's terribly interesting. This is highly intelligent Christianity. To recognize that all formal precipitations are willed, that uniqueness is an essential intent of the original power field called God the Father, that God the Father does not want a world full of identical beings all reciting the same wisdom colored from O levels, at the same time and the same delivery in the same standard English, but he wants them to say it in totally different ways, and preferably not even to say what is in O-levels. He wants them to discover other things, and within the things they discover other things, and all of them totally different, so that no two men can understand each other formally, and don't want to. What they want to do is see what marvellously tricky things they have produced by act of will. When we conceive that this is a fact, that our physical body as animate is evidence of an animating principle, this is of solar origin, solar energy is this biofield, preferred responses, forms or ideas, and will. When we recognize this, then, and not beforehand, can we talk intelligently about evolution, which means that we have to bring out from our beings nothing other than that which is in. Education means leading out. Indoctrination is pushing in. The indoctrinators, say of the fascists or the extreme left, the brainwashing fraternities, like to get rid of the forms you've got and put other forms in your mind of acceptable doctrine. The fundamental will of the universe doesn't like this at all. And therefore we can say that God is a most peculiar fellow that is anti-fascist, anti-communist at the same moment. He doesn't like any attempt to reduce the number of forms as designed by finite human beings who, aware of their own finity of direction, would prefer in order to retain power in their own hands, that your preferred responses shall be those which they design for you. Now, it's quite understandable that at the very highest levels of government there must be intelligent beings. And these intelligent beings have a very good, fundamentally good evolutionary intent. But below these intelligent men, there are other men whose intent is simply the pursuit of individual power. It is not the top rank of government that does stupid things like trying to make everybody equal. It is a lower level who, conscious of their own inferiority of power, wish you not to effervesce, not to be different, in ways that they cannot handle. But the fellows at the very top, who are very, very alert, love you to be beyond their handling, because they are so quick that whatever you produce, they will show a profit from it. They don't need to handle it. They've got the middle fellows to handle it, and they will get the benefit. So here we have a thing that's not a bit like George Orwell's 1984. He thought that Big Brother would control you and have inbuilt television screens there, which you're not allowed to turn off. You are in continuous observation. You are receiving continuous orders. You are predictable. This is a very low-level ambition of not very bright politicians. But above them is something quite different, a real establishment of intelligent beings who are determined to aid the evolution of the human race to very much higher levels than they now possess. And the only way they can do this is to put the squeeze on. An ancient Egyptian word, piezo, which comes into piezoelectricity, is the kind of electricity that's generated when you get a body of matter and squeeze it. If you put a crystal under pressure, it will generate electricity. This is piezoelectricity, squeeze electricity. Now this higher establishment will squeeze people to make them produce new emergence, whereas at lower levels people are trying to squeeze them to stop them producing new emergence. But you see, the lower levels who are trying to control people by squeezing them are self-contradictory, because they don't understand that when you squeeze people they produce new emergence. Whereas the fellows at the top love the idea that when you squeeze people, you get a new emergence.